Blog Talk Radio.
What do you know? What do you know? What do you know?
The birds and the bees are wise to the light.
What do you know?
So they took to the trees and took to the sky.
What do you know?
On top of the chain and safe from the rain.
What do you know?
What you know about the ways of the underside?
What do you know?
I bought a hot shot jet from an old man in Guinea.
What do you know?
Cause they're hip to the bone and hip to the light.
What do you know?
And yep, but you ask cause you ain't got a penny.
What do you know?
What you know about the ways on the underside?
What do you know?
One hot shot cat from a North Bank Guinea.
What do you know?
Ain't it up with your ass cause you ain't got a penny.
What do you know?
Dropping bombs from above cut you all down to size.
What do you know?
Cause the hip to the ball and the hip to the
what do you know?
Yeah, the streets rose in two perfect ways in the night.
What do you know?
One crashes on my left and one on my right. It's all fire and brimstone, baby, so let's go outside.
What do you
it's
know?
It's all fire and brimstone, baby. I got my brand new pistol, baby.
What do you know?
One hot shot cat from a North Bay Guinea.
All right, enough. Darb. Darby, can you hear me? Darby. Darby.
Hello. Yeah.
Hey, okay. All right. Hi. How are you?
Wow, I really can't hear you.
You can't?
Why don't you
Why
talk
can't you
for
hear me?
Well, oh, now I can hear you. Well, you sounded scrambled.
Okay, now
there
you can hear me.
Yep.
I feel like it's sort of like a early 2000, you know, sort of Verizon commercial, right?
Yes, a little
you
bit.
Hear me now? Good.
Yeah.
All right, hello and welcome to Logicast. Logicast is a weekly podcast. We cover topics like politics, religion, skepticism, science, history, philosophy, anything and everything that the co-host slash host wants to talk about. So, we are on every Thursday at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time. And just check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/logicast. So, we have Jeremiah on the line, but I'm going to keep him on hold. You know, he's about to get his his PhD in psychology, so he should be sort of used to listening by now. I mean, I'm just saying, you know. Whatever. I thought it was funny.
Oh,
apparently you didn't, Darby.
Okay. Yes, he should be used to listening. Okay.
God
go ahead.
It.
You have
Jeremiah,
stuff you want to talk about.
Jeremiah messaged me, and he thought it was funny. So,
oh, okay.
You know, apparently my humor just doesn't work on you sometimes. Sometimes I'll tell you jokes, and I'm like, were they really not funny? And I'll ask other people to listen to the show, and they're like, yeah, that was really funny. Darby just does not have a very good sense of humor. So, you know.
Really?
Okay, no, they've never once said that you don't have a good sense of humor. They just said that they thought it was funny.
Okay.
Okay, so let's... By the way, Jeremiah Bean runs the... Actually, Darby, I want you to talk about Jeremiah because I have a man crush on him, which is... has nothing to do with how intelligent he is. It has to do with how good he looks. So I'm not a very good advocate for Jeremiah in terms of his intelligence necessarily. So have you listened to the God Theory podcast? I know you have. I know you've listened to it.
I have.
It's spectacular. I mean, he does a really great job. Jeremiah Bean, by the way, runs the Game Theory podcast and the God Theory podcast. I would hit him on originality, but when we started this show, it was called The Skeptic Experience, so we're not really anyone to comment on sort of other people's originality, if you will. So that was my fault, not yours. You had nothing to do with the name of the show, you know.
I know, I did object to it, but yes.
You did. You were like, this sounds way too much like that show in Austin. And I was like, I know, but I liked him so much. And
Yeah,
now we kind of have our own thing. Anyway, all right, so do you want to talk about what's annoyed you this week, or do I get to talk about what's annoyed me this week?
Oh, I thought I was supposed to say some good things about Jeremiah besides how totally hot he is.
He's a pretty good-looking guy. I mean,
you wanted to leave that to me because you were, you know, it's hard to concentrate.
I did, and then I pontificated. I kept talking,
yeah,
and I mean, you know how that happens.
Yes, one of the reasons that we like having Jeremiah on the show so much is because he he's a smart guy, he's a funny guy, but also he understands how to explain things both effectively and clearly, and also and this is a thing I respect a lot about him, this is a thing I respect a lot about you, Jeremiah, he's very clear about what he's researched and what he hasn't, and he'll say, this is a thing that I've, you know, looked into, I haven't, you know, I've only heard A, B, or C about this, and he doesn't pretend to know things he doesn't know, and this is a thing that earns my respect quickly. And also, I just think he's funny as hell. So that's another thing that makes it great to have him on, because he makes everybody laugh and is able to add insight that we don't have, because he is has expertise in a field that you and I are not experts in. So those are some of the reasons, and plus he's just a cool guy. So anyway, that's why we've got Jeremiah on again. And we're always happy to have him. So
I'm
go
an
ahead
expert
and
at everything.
Talk about yours. Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna let Jeremiah come on, but then I'm gonna talk about what annoys me. Jeremiah.
Okay.
Are you there?
Yes. Yes. Can you hear me? Thank you for that wonderful entrance. You guys are just too nice.
We love you, dude.
And I love you. Obviously, because I've been on here so many times.
I think you're our most reoccurring guest. Actually, you are, for sure. Our most reoccurring guest.
Yeah. Suck it, other guests.
All right, so that's right. That's right. All those people who don't tune into our little podcast here. Hey, by the way, I have to ask, City Skylines, did you pick it up or no?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I haven't had much chance to play it, but it looks awesome. It's definitely complicated.
Yeah, you and I need to have a non-radio show conversation about that game. I'm serious.
Yeah, that sounds great, yeah. You can show me the ropes. Like, tell me all that cool theory.
Like, we need to, right, like, maybe we can do it on Skype with our shirts off. You know what I mean? Like, you have your shirt off,
yeah.
I have my shirt off.
Communicate only through pec flexing? That makes sense. Yeah. Wouldn't be weird.
Like every,
it'd be normal.
Yeah, I guess it would be totally normal. It's just the normal thing people do on Skype. But, you know, when playing games, like, we could just, like, do it together, you know, and we could have our shirts off, and, like, we could hang out and drink beer together, and, you know, I mean.
And just see what happens, you know? Just see what happens.
Totally normal. Like, you could tell your wife to, you know, not worry about what's going on the computer screen, and
yeah.
I could tell my wife. I don't think anything surprises my wife at this point. So, you know, I mean, she would just, like,
yeah.
walk by. She'd be talking. she talks to her father on the weekends usually, so she'll just be walking by the office and be like, yeah, Jared's in there, you know, no shirt on, playing, playing some sim game.
Jared loves semi-nude gaming.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and he's talking to another dude on Skype, and I think that her father would actually probably be like, yeah, it sounds like something Jared would do, you know.
Right.
Whatever, so. So anyway, all right. So I'm going to talk. Jeremiah, have you been following what's been going on with this We Are Atheism thing? Have you heard about this?
No.
Okay. Darby has heard about this, so I'm going to bring, you know, sort of Darby into the conversation about the We Are Atheism thing. So, Darby, you're so much better at being brief than I am. Real quick, can you kind of just sum up what's going on with the We Are Atheism thing, and then I'm going to give my thoughts on it, and then we'll move on to the topic at hand tonight.
Okay. Well, Hemant Mehta, who blogs at The Friendly Atheist, and seems indeed to be a friendly atheist and a nice guy and a good guy for thoroughness, and I appreciate that about him, brought up a couple days ago that there some problems have arisen with the We Are Atheism, which is a company that was started a couple of years ago. I'll let you go into what, the intricacies of what kind of company and how that works. And he just brought up some issues around the nonprofit status of the company, how the money was managed, where the money was dispersed, which didn't always go to where it was supposed to necessarily. There were some problems with, you know, one thing on the website officially said that nobody had taken a salary, but it turned out that somebody had taken a salary. And, there were a lot of claims about, well, we couldn't give the money to these people, and so we decided to give it to these other people instead. And there was the donors that had, you know, donated to, say, the tornado in Texas. Their money was actually not going to tornado victims; it was going somewhere else. So there were a whole bunch of issues brought up, and he did so very sort of directly and civilly. This wasn't like a mudslinging thing. And mostly it was an effort to be transparent, because we've all seen these churches who are run by crooks, and I mean truly crooks. Of course, not all churches are, but there are a bunch of them that are, you know, this guy who's trying to raise money to buy himself a G6 airplane or whatever, and people who say, oh, yes, it's still a nonprofit, and we're, you know, gazillionaires, and we're still asking poor people in our congregation for money, and we don't have to tell you where it goes. Well, you know, a lot of people who are atheists and part of a community or the skeptic atheist secular community would like to not do that. We don't want to have that kind of shady dealings happening, and especially when it's supposed to be a charity that we're giving our money to. We want transparency and good sort of critical scrutiny of what is happening. We kind of want to set an example of, like, this is what this stuff is supposed to be like. And so Hemant brought this up and asked the people about these problems and got some responses that were less than satisfactory to a lot of people reading it. And so that's where that's the situation that was happening here. And you wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, I do, if only because I know the Browns very well. I mean, Adam and I have been friends for a long time. I disagree with Adam on a lot of things, one of which we're actually going to talk about here momentarily. But having said that, the number of mistakes that I made in business, because you have to understand, like, I didn't come from a business background. Like, I had no idea how to run a business. It was basically just sort of, you know, thrown in my lap, and it was like, okay, you know, run this and then learn it as you go along. And I've made so many mistakes, and you know, if I were to have taken a position running a business, I would have probably been fired within the first 3 or 4 months. You know, my boss understood that I didn't, the CEO of our corporation understood that I didn't know how to run a business whenever I took all this on. Not only did I not know how to run a business, I also didn't know really anything about the business in which I was tasked with running. So, understanding all of that, I do have some sympathy for Amanda. I really do. And, you know, she and I have butted heads on multiple occasions over quite a few things. Adam and I remain friends today. I mean, I quit Atheism Resource a while ago, and, you know, he and I still talk regularly. You know, he actually does some design work for my company. I'm actually writing a blog right now sort of, you know, explaining to people the mistakes she made and why they shouldn't make those mistakes, you know, in the future. It goes back to that, you know, it actually goes back to something Rumsfeld said. You know, I mean, we, you know, there are known knowns and known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. You know, one of the things that is so often said in business or in the business world, at least in the world that I frequent so often, is that you don't know what you don't know. And the problem is that because you don't know it, you don't know what to expect from it. I don't think that Amanda did anything maliciously. I think that she just was ignorant and probably did have best intentions. In fact, I was talking to Adam when all of the Sandy Hook stuff was going on. I was still an administrator on Atheism Resource. But I could have told you that I didn't think she was qualified to run that business, to run We Are Atheism as a charity. I mean, I could have told you that from meeting her and from, you know, conversations with her. I mean, you know, some people, I don't believe the idea that some people have it and some people don't. I think some people can be trained and some people can't. I don't think she was one of those people that could have been trained to do this. Because I again, from my personal interactions with her, I think that, unfortunately, you know, she has, in her mind, a certain way to run things, and then the government and everybody else has another way in which they would, you know, sort of run things. And, you know, sort of a, just sort of a personal, you know, kind of reflection, you know, not against her as a human being. I, you know, just don't think she ever should have been in charge of a 501c3. Let me put it that way. You know, and again, that's my own personal opinion. I know her very well. Her and Adam are wonderful people. They really are. And I'm not just, you know, saying that as some sort of a ridiculous disclaimer, like I owe them anything. I absolutely don't. You know, regardless, the practices that were employed throughout the entire process have been absolutely terrible. I mean, this is, you know, literally, if I were going to write a book on how not to, you know, start and, you know, an atheist charity or really any charity, I would basically start off with using every single thing that Amanda Brown did wrong and, you know, explain why you shouldn't do that. I don't mean that personally. She didn't know, and a lot of people don't. For example, originally back in 2012, whenever We Are Atheism was started, it was started as a DBA. In the business world, a DBA is a doing business as. So it's not necessarily a legal entity. It is a, you know, it is a legal entity doing business as something else, okay? In the case of Missouri, it also tends to be the case in Texas, a sole proprietor, a person, a citizen can actually, you know, do business as whatever they want, any fictitious name. Now, there are some
you know, requirements that come with that, one of them being at any time you have this name, someone can come along and, you know, take that name from you and they can legally register it. So if you fast forward to May 2013, that's actually when We Are Atheism filed its articles of incorporation, okay? So from that date is where everything spawns from. Prior to May 2013, back in December of 2012, I was still definitely a part of Atheism Resource and, you know, very, well, familiar, we'll say, with the Browns. And they were raising money on behalf of We Are Atheism. The problem is that We Are Atheism was taking money from people and then giving it to charities. And from what Amanda said in her responses to Hemant, is that she was taking some cash off the top of that in order to pay her salary, okay, for her time. The problem is that you can't represent yourself as a nonprofit charity when you aren't a nonprofit charity. You can't take people's money claiming that it's going to be used for charitable donations and then pay yourself a salary if you aren't a 501c3. She did that with the Sandy Hook money, and, you know, I had a few family members who are lawyers look into that, and basically what both of them said was that she's probably guilty of fraud, whether federally or based on state law, she's probably guilty of fraud at some point. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and obviously I don't know how true that is, and, you know, both of the people that I talked to told me they were not familiar with, you know, with Missouri or Kansas statutes. But that's what they said it seemed like. It would be like someone calling and saying, hey, I'm with this, you know, private organization or this, you know, this charity, you know, and you're soliciting donations and then people give you donations and you take that money, you give some of the money to the charity, but then you take some of that money, you hold it for yourself, but you're not actually a charitable organization. So the time
right,
frame
we need to be
in which that
we also need to
in
be
which
clear
that
about,
happened. Go ahead.
I just want to make something clear. There is absolutely, of course, there are administrative costs for 501c3s, but the problem is you have to make those clear to the donors, and you have to make it clear on your website or your the information in your business, like, we have this much, you know, that goes to overhead or whatever. And the problem was when salary was being dispersed, it had already been said that there was no salary taken, because, of course, nonprofits pay their people. But that has to be a transparent thing that comes in. The donors have information that this percentage is going to the overhead salary or whatever other overhead costs is happening. And that wasn't the case there, right? So,
pretty much. I mean, it actually is a little bit deeper than that in the sense that there was no 501c3 for her to claim.
Yes.
Tax-deductible
yeah.
donations, which is what she was doing long before there were articles of incorporation, long before they submitted, you know, their 501, you know, C3 paperwork to the IRS. I mean, you know, it's sort of like me saying, Darby, give me $100, I'm going to give it to charity. It's 100% tax deductible, but I have no reason to believe it's tax deductible other than I just simply don't understand how the law works and, you know, how the IRS tax code works. It's very unfortunate. I think it is, because I think that Amanda probably had very good intentions. I know both her and Adam personally. I think part of the problem is that good intentions do not equal, I hate to say this, competency. And when you are not competent with regard to these, you know, structural and sort of complex issues, you should not be running a, you know, a nonprofit or really any business. I'm going to detail this on my blog, and you know, I mean, obviously I post things infrequently on it. But, I'm going to go into a lot more depth and a lot more detail and explain, because she brought up some publications with regard to what, you know, this IRS agent had told her, and one of the publications doesn't even exist. And, you know, and again, it's not to you know, bemoan her or to insult her at all. It's just to kind of demonstrate, if you want to run a 501c3 and you are a non-believer, these are the things you should not do. You know, and I mean, she gave some pretty good reasons why you shouldn't do these things.
Well,
you know?
Go
ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to say this is sort of dovetails into what we're talking about, because a lot of her responses that were posted, Hemant posted her responses to his questions. I counted four times in a row that she blamed somebody else for the problem. She blamed, you know, the website was supposed to be updated, but I trusted the wrong person, and it was never updated, and it was his or her fault. And then Hemant asked who, so he could confirm it, and she wouldn't say. And then she said, I was told by an IRS agent this ABC, and that isn't what any other IRS agent that anyone has checked with has said. And he asked, who was that? What's the badge number? And she didn't know. And then she said, I had a CPA trainee looking at this, and she said that this was all okay. And he said, well, can I talk to her? And she said, no. And then she said, a lawyer told me this was okay. And he said, well, can I call the lawyer and talk to them and see why they gave this advice? And she said she didn't remember who it was. And then she said, you know, I tried to give the money to this A, B, and C people, and they told me to die and go to hell. They didn't want money from an atheist organization. That was a direct quote that she said. And they didn't want money from the atheist organizations. And he said, well, who were these? So I know who they are, so we all can know who refuses money from atheist organizations. And she said she didn't remember. So what we're talking about on the show today is sort of how to approach stuff when it appears that you were wrong, and how you could learn from being wrong, admitting you're wrong. I think there were a couple times there that she should have just said, I was wrong. And she did say, I fucked up PayPal. She was very clear about that. But it kind of came with some caveats. But, you know, I did this, this person should have done that, but the CPA said. So that's kind of what we're heading for today on the show. So I thought I'd just throw that in there.
Perfect segue. And you're right. I mean, that really, all of that is what happened is, you know, it was, you know, X, Y, and Z, the fault of, you know, people X, Y, and Z. It was not, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what questions to ask. You know, I didn't know what to investigate. I just assumed that I was good because these people in authority, people I believed were in authority, told me. And by the way, if you have contributed to We Are Atheism and you fundamentally believe that, you know, your contributions prior to May 2013 are tax deductible, let me tell you right now that they are not. I spoke with an IRS agent. And by the way, I've spoken to the IRS on multiple occasions, just to defend Amanda in this sense. I've spoken to them on multiple occasions. Because unlike most Americans, I actually had to pay them money. And I will say that I've never, up until the guy I talked to, this Jeff guy, and I've got all of his information in my blog, I never thought to write down the badge number of, you know, of the IRS agent. I don't think most people would think to do that, and I can't really fault Amanda for not doing that, because it's like, okay, I'm going to call and I'm going to get this information and blah, blah, blah. In retrospect, yeah, it seems like she should have, but again, in retrospect, we all should have done a lot of things, you know?
Yeah.
So I should have gone to law school after I graduated college. But anyway. All right. Why your brain hates being wrong. Darby, I'm going to let you go since I've spent the first 30 minutes basically talking.
here's what I want to talk about. I've noticed, and I, of course, we will never, you and I will never on the show, speak for all atheists or all skeptics or all secular people, and I'm not doing that now, but I've noticed there's a tendency, and we've all heard it, and we've all said it because it happens a lot, to when you're talking to religious people and they're intractable and they absolutely refuse to listen to anything you say, even if you're bringing up stuff, they may deflect with, you know, that doesn't matter to me, or it's just say, or, you know, I don't care. And that's fine. And then there's this sort of accusation that gets thrown out sometimes. Well, you know, you will never admit if you're wrong, or you can't even look at the evidence to evaluate it to see if you're wrong. And yet you and I have seen personally quite a few skeptics, and I'm just going to say human beings, because this is a problem with human beings. But the reason I'm even bringing up skeptics and atheists is because they tend to have especially people who are proud skeptics, tend to have sometimes a hard time admitting that they're wrong. And a skeptic should be the first person to admit when they're wrong, because the whole point is that you evaluate evidence to see if you're right or wrong, not to go, see, I'm fucking right about that. I'm right about everything. I'm a skeptic. You know, I wonder, because I've seen people do it, you know, do both ways, and it seems I gain respect immediately for people when they can admit that they're wrong. I had the wrong idea about that. I did the wrong thing. I should have done this. And then there's full stop. There's no, I did, but I was really angry because so-and-so was so awful to me, so it's no wonder I said that terrible thing. Or I had really low blood sugar, or, you know, and then they start with all these outside factors that have mitigated their, you know, and they start excusing it. And it's really easy to stop there and not excuse, or not take responsibility, and instead start funneling responsibility off by making excuses. And to me, you can learn the most and redirect your life in the best way when you make a mistake by saying, I was wrong, I did that. And explaining why you did it is fine. You can, it's without excusing it. I did it because I had the wrong idea about this, and I really felt like I was right, and that I was wrong. And so I'm going to fix this now. I can't tell you how much respect I have for somebody that does that. And there's a weird thing where people, I think they're saving face by scrapping and clawing at their old idea or their mistake, and hoping that no one will notice that they're making stupid excuses or saying, oh, I'm too tired to talk about this now, which I've heard several times. I'm like, really? That's where you're going to go with that? Like, it's hard for me to understand. I know there are several things. I learned the name of one of them today, which I'm sure Jeremiah will be happy to talk about. Maybe, I don't know. And because we've talked about this before, I didn't have a name for it, the sunk cost fallacy.
Yeah.
And this is one of my pet things that I have kept bringing up over and over again, and Jared and I have talked about it with mythicism. But Jeremiah, do you want to talk about that a little bit? I know there's a kind of weird thing with behaviorism and the sunk cost fallacy, but I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, now that the crowd's warmed up with all that tax law talk, I know I'm excited.
Woo!
It's pumped. Ready to go? Man, 501c3. Might as well be talking about the Spurs game. I was totally lost on that, but I learned a little bit, so thanks. Actually, I learned a lot. Literally everything you said, I learned something from, because I knew nothing. But yeah, the sunk cost fallacy, that's like, I think some people are familiar with this, and I was also screwed. I actually wouldn't be in psychology right now if it weren't for someone calling this out to me, because I was in marketing, right, like as an undergraduate, and I've been doing it for like 2 years, maybe 3 years at this point. I was a non-traditional student, so I can't really remember, but been doing it for a while, and then that's when I went to Warren. I came back, and I was like, I want to learn about people and, like, human behavior. That's totally awesome. And I was like, but I'm too far along now. I've put 3 years in. I've sunk all that cost in. I'm ready to just go ahead and get the degree. I'm a year out. And then actually my brother-in-law, Brian, he called it out to me. He's like, I'm pretty sure that's this thing called the sunk cost fallacy. It's like this psychology thing. And I was like, oh, psychology. Because I didn't know anything about it. But, it's just like whenever you put a lot of work into something or a lot of, work in general, then you want to see something out of it. It's like, well, I've already done this for so long, and now, you know, I'm in it till the end. I'm just going to finish this thing, put my head down and finish it out, even if you don't really agree with the end anymore, you know? So kind of like the opposite of, like, stopping what you're doing, going to the very beginning and saying, would I do this all again if I knew what I knew now? And if the answer is no, then just stop. Stop doing that thing, you know?
stop immediately. There's, yeah, and this, people use this for stuff all the time. Like, well, you know, I'm not happy in my relationship, but I've been with him for five years and I've put all this time in, and I've said to people before, and they said it to me, if you'd done 5 years in prison, would you stay because you've decorated your cell?
That's perfect. I'm going to use that.
Go right ahead. That's kind of what the argument is. But of course, it's different because there are lots more good things about the relationship probably than there are in prison. But
then there
so
are.
People use that
well,
all the
I
time.
Guess it depends
religion.
On, you know, who you are in prison, right? I mean,
yeah, right.
You know.
Yeah.
But you get that with people and religion all the time, or any sort of belief. If you're sort of, especially if there's embarrassment attached to, like, I used to believe that, so yeah. I'm a smart moral person, I'm intelligent, I'm good at evaluating information, and that is the idea you have about yourself. And so for some reason people get to the point where they're like, well, shit, if I had that wrong, then maybe all of these things about me are wrong, which isn't true. You can, smart people who are good at evaluating information make mistakes all the time. That's part of how you get to be good at evaluating information. But people will stay in their particular brand of woo, or stick with, I mean, I've had conversations with people about homeopathy where I, like, explained, a lot of people don't know the difference between homeopathy and, like, natural remedies, which is very different. And when I explain the difference, they get a little, you know, they start getting amped up and start going, well, I know these teething tablets work because I've given them to my baby. And even though it seems like, well, shit, you know, what I thought was right wasn't right, or I have no way of even defending my position, I've told all these people about it, and I've, you know, been advocating it for years, so I just have to keep doing it, or I'm not the person I thought I was. And I guess my issue with that is, you know, your cognitive dissonance gong gets rung, and you end up there, instead of going, well, I made a mistake there, oh, well, and there are always going to be some dicks out there who go, you fucking idiot, I can't believe you. But you ignore those people, and you listen to the people who go, wow. I mean, it's getting so rare that people often praise you online for going, wow, you admitted you were wrong and changed your mind. Awesome, you know. But even if you don't, you realize that your decision-making abilities start to improve, and you feel less of this cognitive discomfort because you're not trying to justify your shit. Like, I have to be right all the time. I can't admit I'm wrong. I put all these years into this, or I, you know, and I was talking to Jared about Ryan Bell, who did the Year Without God thing, and he was a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. And a lot of people have come out of religion and clergy, the clergy projects, and said, I was wrong about this. But he actually blogged his way through the whole leaving process. Even though he kind of was already an atheist, but he certainly hadn't admitted that to himself or anything. And it wasn't easy because people were constantly condescending to him, and then the religious people were threatening him, and he just kept plugging along, and he was pretty articulate and wrote this great blog. And I thought, that's the way you do it, right? You say, oh, looks like I was wrong about this, and here's why I think I was wrong about that, so I'm going to move on to this next thing. But that's such a rarity. That's my point, I guess. I think, if you want to call yourself a skeptic, isn't it best to evaluate information, and instead of becoming entrenched because you feel like you have to be fucking right, and when I was religious, I used to be wrong, and I'm not doing that shit again. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of nuance here, Jeremiah, with, like, ego and people's weird, you know, band-aids they put on themselves to try to
educate us, Jeremiah. Educate us. We are. We want the education.
I'll get ready. I got the psychology chat. I'm ready to swing it. Basically, like, okay, there's a few things going on there. And, like, one is, like, we have this fusion of, in one of the evidence-based therapies, it's called acceptance commitment therapy. Basically, we get this idea that we get fused with our thoughts, and, like, our thoughts are ourselves, and therefore they are, you know, true indications of who we are and whatnot. And one of those things is that, for example, if I'm, like, lifting weights or something, which I almost never do because it hurts, but, like, when I do it, I'll be listening, all of a sudden I'm like, I can't do it, I can't. And I listen to that, and I think it's a true statement. But I think all of us know that you can usually get, like, one or two more reps out. That's a bad analogy. I don't know why I said that. I think it's because my muscles are sore, because I got my butt kicked at the gym the other day.
Yeah,
but anyway.
No,
like,
if you have a trainer, you always know how many more you can get, because they know. Jerk.
Yeah. So you have this idea that, like, you know, like, that says, you know, my thoughts are who I am. And so you take offense whenever somebody tells you your thoughts are wrong. But instead, like, we teach people, and we do this in, like, marital therapy, that you need to have a unified detachment from the problem. And that just means, like, you and your spouse need to look at the problem like it's a third entity. It's not something intrinsic in the other person. It's not like two people are intrinsic. Some value inside of them is wrong, and they need to change it. Instead, it's like, oh, hey, we got a problem here. That's interesting. Let's check it out. And you hold it lightly and dispassionately, right? Like almost like a scientist does, where they look at a problem and they say, oh, that's interesting. Let's figure this out. And so if you hold it that way, then you're not going to have a problem when you're wrong. So you're just like, oh, that's hilarious. I came about that the wrong way the first time. Let's try again. You know, I think that's like the solve. So that would be like the therapeutic way I'd approach it. But then, yeah, as far as like the theoretical, have you ever heard of the Zygarnik effect?
The what?
Well, I think I'm saying it right. It's a Russian name. Zygarnik?
No, but I love that you always teach me this stuff. What is that? What's that thing?
Okay. Well, it's from this, like, really old, old-timey idea. Well, not idea, but a long time ago, there's a psychologist, and he was sitting in a cafe, and this waitress comes up, and he notices something about her, and it's that she retains memories longer whenever... when they're not completed. So when she completed someone's order, she was quick to forget them. And then whenever she hadn't yet completed someone's order, she would still remember. And the modern idea of that is that, you know, we have this like kind of self-monitoring portion of our brains that kind of keeps it in the loop and refreshes it in our short-term memory. And, you know, that takes literal energy, right? And it's kind of annoying. So we want to be like certain of something, and then we want to let it go. But when you're wrong, you can never be certain. You know, we have this idea that we want to resolve it. Everything's a problem to us, you know, especially in the Western part of the world. We have a hard time with like mysteries. So we feel like, oh, mystery therefore needs to be solved. And so like it takes a lot of brain power. And we showed over like many different models, like the elaboration likelihood model or other things, that we don't like doing that. If we can, we're just going to use a heuristic and get over it. So being uncertain or being called wrong means I've got a bunch of work for you to do here. And like you said, there's also that social component where for some reason, like people think that like it's a bad thing to change your thoughts. And I think that's partly because we, like with language, I can impart to someone language through my language, like a little bit of power, right? I can say, hey, yeah, here's how you approach this. Like in therapy, for example, you have panic. Well, hey, you know, 4 to 6 sessions and you're better. That's like powerful, right? So in a way that, well, I think that kind of taps into the primate part of our brain. You see someone as this holder of power, and if they're continuously discredited over time, they lose that power, which is, you know, a social hierarchy of a certain kind. So I think there's kind of that sensitivity to it. Wow. But
interesting.
Let me ask you this, Jeremiah. I have a question. So, you know, you always hear the statement that, you know, someone who is, you know, sort of talked into bullshit. You know, rather the phrase basically goes that, you know, someone can't reason themselves out of something they weren't reasoned into, right? Like you've heard that statement.
Oh, right.
I wonder if people can be talked into things based on bullshit. I mean, doesn't it stand to reason that they're the best way to talk them sort of out of that is with an equal amount of bullshit?
Yeah, that's one way to approach it. What that basically means is there's kind of two ways we change our attitudes, and this is like that elaboration likelihood model I was talking about just a second ago. We actually talked about it on the on my show, the God Theory one, that we're just about to make a real podcast right now. It's just on YouTube, but I kind of discussed that of like how people change their mind, and one is through, like you said, kind of like this bullshit idea of heuristics. So we've got heuristics we lean on, one of which is like, oh, that's a good-looking dude, but that's a good-looking girl, therefore I believe what they say. Like, it's called the halo effect, right? And then you've got, like, a bunch of different things, but one is, like, the frequency of which you hear something, the more likely you are to consider it, like, correct, which is weird. You know, that just means so, like, an echo chamber. Right, right. Yeah, it's called an illusory truth effect. But if you, Oh, elaboration, yeah. So there's different ways to change people's minds, and people really research this quite a bit. But it kind of depends on how they believe it, on how you need to approach it, which is pretty interesting. Like what kind of message you need to craft. But no matter what, there's a main effect that we do know is true, and that is that thoughts that go through our central route of persuasion, which is like the systematic thinking. Like if I was like, Jared, let's sit down and talk about city skylines, right, with our shirts off and flexing our pecs. Let's do that. And then you go on to, like, tell me a reasonable argument that I spend time kind of, you know, going over and that kind of thing. Then that one has a stronger effect on our attitude or our, you know, kind of underlying belief than anything that has to do with persuasion. You just have to force feed someone into that route if they don't want to do it, which is, there's tricks to that, but.
Right. Block the shortcut.
So let me ask you this,
you have to block,
Jeremiah.
Block the shortcut is what I said, yeah. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah. Sorry, Darby, I didn't mean to interrupt you. The delay really sucks, dude, I got to tell you. Every single week we have the same problem. Okay, so would you agree that people are hardwired to, like, accept concepts that agree with their currently held views? I mean, that's sort of self-evident, right? Like, I assume you would agree with that. So then you have something called the backfire effect, which basically says that the hypothesis behind the backfire effect, which you probably know more about than I do, essentially asserts that, you know, that thinking about negative stimuli more than positive stimuli has an evolutionary benefit in the sense that the former is sort of precautionary, whereas the latter is usually benign, right? So, for example, someone says something that I agree with, I tend to not dismiss it. It just kind of flows through the filter because I already agree with it. But when someone says something that runs contradictory to what I currently think, I will focus on it and try to figure out ways to disprove it because I like my current bias. Right, like I like my current thought process, and it has worked for me, and that's just the way I'm going to be.
Yeah, that's the confirmation bias. And then what's happening there is, like, okay, so there's this idea about humans, and I have a hard time disproving it, so I kind of buy into it, is that, being a skeptic, I think that's our default position, right? But is that we're cognitive misers, which is, that just means, I guess misers is like an old school way to say, like, lazy people, like a lazy guy. So we're like, we don't like to think about things because it literally takes energy, right? Like that brain activity takes energy. It takes, time, or it takes, and in a time of like food resource scarcity, which we don't have in North America, but back then we did, you don't want to be thinking a whole lot if you don't have to, right? Because I'm sure you've heard, like, it takes a lot of, like, water and energy just to sit and think for a while. I'm not sure if you've seen those sorts of studies, but anyway, so we don't want to use that energy if we're going to be trying to live on the savannah, right? So the idea was, you know, we try not to mull things over or anything like that if we don't have to. And so we tend to just have this confirmation bias, just let it slip through. And that's called the peripheral route of persuasion. You know, that's like that easy one. You just kind of let it in, and it has a weak effect on our attitude, but, you know, over time, that can really build up. So, yeah, and like you said, two things predict the which way this is going to go. The easy route, where you let it slip by, or the systematic route, where you kind of really mull over it. And it's motivation and ability. So, like, are you motivated? One, you said that, you know, it's contrary to your current belief. And is that current belief something you hold valuable, right? Because, like, if you said, Jeremiah, you're supposed to use baking soda instead of baking powder, I wouldn't be like, bullshit! You know, I'd be like, oh, okay. You know, so that's fine. I would let it slip on by. I'm not motivated. I'm able to, like, you know, probably Google that, but I'm not motivated. And then, you know, likewise, if you're able, or if you're motivated but not able, you know, let's say you have, you know, you're unfortunate enough to have an intellectual disability or something like that, you can't really tackle the subject, and you want to, but you usually just go with a heuristic because you don't know how to systematically think through it. And so you kind of have to have both. And once you have motivation and ability, so if I said something like, hey, Jared, did you know that white people are more likely to get arrested by the police than black people? You'd be like, what? You know, and so you'd probably, you know, really systematically think that one through because you're motivated and able.
So one of the things that, okay, let me put it this way. Here's something I've always wanted to know. Do you think that people will disqualify evidence that does not immediately, they'll immediately disqualify evidence that does not agree with their current worldview?
Yeah. This is a cool new study. Maybe I can link it to you after the show. And you can, like, throw in the show notes or something. There's a cool study that was done.
Not to interrupt you real quick. I just want to clarify this point. Like, even evidence, literal evidence that comes from reputable, demonstrable sources, like, they will disqualify all of this evidence.
Yeah. There's a study on that. I need to show it to you. I think it was done in 2013, maybe 14, but it was done, and the findings were that contrary evidence to your like something you hold valuable, evidence to the contrary actually activates our fight or flight syndrome. So like,
yes,
so it makes people believe it even more.
It makes people react to you like you're attacking me, and that's where this comes from. I think like you present, and I am really careful to be civil and gentle and respectful to humans, not to ideas when I talk to them. But I've had people say, "How can you attack me in this way?" And I feel like that's what it is. It's their fight or flight, because I've pinged this little thing at them, and it's ethereal. It's not really a thing, but what they're feeling is like marble being thrown at their face or something.
Yeah. No, it does. And unfortunately, there's an effect of that where, I don't know if you guys are familiar with, you're probably familiar with like roughly of like the brain structures. Well, you know, you've got your kind of reptilian brain, which is your old school brain. And then we've got that brain that we kind of developed as a primate. If you believe in all that evolution stuff.
Oh,
but,
God, if
like,
you believe in that.
Fucking God, all right. Shit, I don't believe in any of that.
See, there you go. You're offended by my idea. So you're proving my point, freaking goober. But no. So basically, you get this intent. You inhibit blood flow from your frontal lobes, which is where you do all your kind of rational thinking, all of our developed thinking. Yeah. So it goes down into the – yeah. It just pumps through like this limbic system, which the limbic system is based on your amygdala, which is kind of your emotional center, you know, let's put it that way. Like, it's the most important part in the emotions. And so it's going to crank you up either happy or sad, right? Fight or flight or freeze. Actually, there's a third one they found. But anyway, if you can bring down that feeling, then you can get blood flow restored to the frontal lobes. That's why in, like, arguments on the internet, I'm always overly nice. I'm like, yeah, you're a really considerate and good person. I really appreciate that. And then that allows their blood flow to re-enter their frontal lobes, and they can actually listen to me rationally rather than reacting to me as an enemy or my thoughts as an enemy, which we've shown happens, which is insane.
Yes, and I've tried hard to do that myself. I think I just need to be even more over the top about it, because I try to like affirm what they've said, that like that yes, I agree, and here's why I think that's really smart or whatever, and then present the point. But I still often get like, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Let me ask you this. You're fine. Would you say that the response process of someone whose ideas are being challenged are mechanical or are they conscientious of how their brain is responding? I mean, this is a really important point.
Well, okay. There's this idea that I'm fundamentally... Yeah, there's an idea that I'm fundamentally opposed to, and it's this idea of hardwiring. First of all, there's no such thing as hardwiring. There's a neurogenesis all the time in our brain, right? But it's called neuroplasticity, which means we do pruning, which means like you have on your nerves, your neurons, they look like a tree, and pruning is exactly what it sounds like. You kind of cut off branches, your brain does, because it's, you know, less efficient. It's like, oh, I'm not using that part anymore. I'm going to prune it down. And then you've got things like long-term potentiation, LTP. LTP happens all along your central nervous system and in your brain, and it's like the growing of axiomatic buttons and dendritic spikes. Like, basically, it's like strengthening the connection, and that's what happens whenever you use your brain a lot. So that, when people are like, my brain's broke, I'm like, so? Fix it. And they're like, I can't. I'm born this way. What? And I'm like, nope. You can change your brain. And the second is we've got a cool thing in our brain. nope. I don't know what you're talking about. But anyway, like you've got a switch in your brain, like a central kind of control, right? So like which is cool with us, you know, we have this, you know, most like, at least lower forms don't have this. I say lower forms, it's also judgmental, but I love you too, newts. But anyway, they can't like direct these impulses in their brain any much way, which we can. Like, for example, if I have a stimulus come up, like let's say something, I don't know, horribly war-related comes into my brain and start like freaking out a little bit. And I'm like, oh man, this is scary, right? And like people are like, well, you're just wired to do that. And I'm like, no, you can redirect that through mindfulness process, which is, you know, you basically take the incoming stimuli and then you reroute it back to the part of your brain that processes contextual ideas. So like, you know, the frontal lobes, like portions of the frontal lobes, like the frontal cortex. But and then you can control your reaction and your bodily function through that. So that's a really cool thing we have that so many people who are in this hardwired camp don't get, because they never studied it. They just hear your brain is like hardwired. And I'm like, no, the computer model was thrown away in the late 80s. Keep with the times, y'all. It's totally different. It's a sweet organ that, like, you know, responds to its stimulus in its environment. But anyway, so, yeah, I think we are hardwired, but we can undo it.
Yes. I was laughing at your, like, I was born this way, well, change it. And you said on the people saying, I have a chemical imbalance. And you're like, there's no such thing. That's not a thing. You know, like,
yeah.
and I
mean, all of life is sort of like a chemical imbalance, isn't it? I mean, you know, in kind of a weird way. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
That imbalance, is the question. Yeah. What is
balance? As they say in as one of my cool philosophy professors used to say, he'd say that statement requires a predicate. And I was like, what? And, you know, because imbalance for what? For what is an imbalance? Is it an imbalance for your happiness? Well, yeah, you're sad right now. You know, and like, oh, well, it's imbalanced for me becoming happy. No, it's not. No, it's ready to go. Your neurotransmitters are in this little corral. They're sequestered off. They're ready to be fired off. You just have to do it. And then that's how we behaviorally activate. You know, we trick our CNS into thinking we're loving life, and then you start loving life. It's like the feedback loop you get when you make someone smile, you know, and then over time they become happier. It's like the weirdest things. Yeah,
that's
like
weird.
You were just,
when I read about that, I was like, is that true? And it seems like yes. The stuff I read, it seemed like yes.
Yeah,
depression is doing.
There's a few different theories on depression as far as biological, like people who, you know, are evolutionary psychologists. And one of them is that it was supposed to sequester you off of a group, you know, pull you away, and then you just slowly die by yourself because you're not helping society, right? So one of the ways we counter that is behavioral activation, which means we get them up and make them think that they're, you know, socially happy and excitable. So we say, nope, get up off the couch, go out and do these things. They're like, I don't feel like it. And I'm like, I know, you super don't. I get that. But you need to do it anyway. And once they do, your depression begins to remit. That's one of the five principles of treating depression. You're kind of tricking yourself into thinking you're valuable, and you become valuable. So it's pretty crazy.
That is
sure, but
very
you're,
cool and weird. It doesn't make sense. But it's I get it.
But at that
I mean,
point, you're doing so. At that point, you're kind of doing so because it's a because you're performing work, right? So, I mean, your body is kind of, you know, being forced to move, forced to act, right? Or am I getting that all wrong? I mean, that's a part of that whole equation, isn't it? I mean, it's not just how you feel internally, right?
Well, I mean, internalization, it has to do with judgment, which is, you know, like a function of the prefrontal cortex, like we said earlier, the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, if I need to be specific. Basically, it's this judgment of ourselves. Well, that judgment goes back and gets stored in our brain like it's any other kind of stimuli. So we take it literally, where basically what we're teaching them to do is we teach them. So the cognitive restructuring bit of depression, of fixing depression, has to do with that. You're teaching yourself to kick back the kind of thoughts that aren't, you know, that way, and your brain will store those literally. So, I mean, we understand the biological mechanisms. We just use a phenomenalistic way of talking so that people understand, you know, or can follow us. Because if I'm like, kick that forward to your prefrontal cortex or kick back your hippocampus and stores like a literal stimulus. No one cares, right? They don't understand. So. Yeah.
I bet no one has ever said it in that tone of voice before, which is
I bet. You know what? I bet they haven't. I really bet they haven't. Jeremiah, we're down to 2 minutes. I mean, it's flown by. Man, dude, my mind is blown. Like, I got it to, like, start. Like, you know, learned a lot here.
Yes, me too.
That's
glad,
great.
Man.
We had, like,
a lot
of things. We had a lot of things we actually wanted to bring up. I know I did, and you pretty much destroyed all of them and made them completely irrelevant. Like,
no, I brought up most of my stuff, but I'm thrilled that a lot of it got explained in a way that I couldn't have explained it because I was sort of, you know, tripping along with, it's nice that, like, the brain.
All right, we got 60
so cool
seconds. We gotta go.
All right.
Jeremiah, thank you for coming on. We always love to have you on. You have been listening to LogicCast. We are on every Thursday, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/LogicCast. And we will let our song play us out. Thank you, Jeremiah.
Thanks, Jeremiah.
Thanks, Jeff.
What do you know? So they took to the trees and took to the sky.
know?
Would you know about the ways of the underside?